Radio.ie hosts the Irish History Show podcast because history matters. Radio turns 100 years young this year. Radio's history is powered by Radio Archives. For radio archiving solutions from people passionate about radio, visit radio.ie.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show. My name is Cathal Brennan, and as always, I'm joined by my co-presenter, John Dorney from theirishstory.com. Please check out our friends at radio.ie for all your radio archiving solutions. You can find this episode and all our previous episodes on our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can follow us on Twitter, at Irish History Pod, or on Facebook, facebook.com/theirishhistoryshow. If you get a chance, please rate and review the show on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help us. And if you hear an episode you like, please share it on your social media. We are really grateful for all the support we receive from you, the listeners. John has set up a Patreon for The Irish Story and The Irish History Show. And if you would consider supporting the show, there is a link in the show notes below. Thank you. Now, on this episode of the show, we are very pleased to be joined again by Dr. Aidan Beattie. Dr. Beattie is a lecturer in the History Department of Carnegie Mellon University and has previously taught at the University of Pittsburgh, Wayne State University, and the University of Chicago. He currently serves as Vice President of the American Conference for Irish Studies. We've had Aidan on the show before discussing the links between Zionism and Irish nationalism, and you can find that in our archives. Aidan has written three books: Masculinity and Power in Irish Nationalism, Private Property and the Fear of Social Chaos, and his latest work on the subject of today's podcast, The Party is Always Right, The Untold Story of Gerry Healy and British Trotskyism, published by Pluto Press. Aidan, you're very welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.
Now, this is the Irish History Show. So why are we discussing a figure from British Trotskyism?
Well, partly that's because Gerry Healy was born in Galway in 1913. And in some ways, Ireland plays an odd role in his development as a political leader. He's not the nicest of people. He's not the most likable of people. And that's maybe an understatement. One of his less bad, but still fairly bad traits is he had a tendency to create a lot of myths about himself, a lot of mythology about himself. And Ireland plays a big role in that. So he claimed to all of his followers, and a lot of them would repeat this and believe this, that he grew up in total poverty on the west of Ireland. He was born, as I said, in December 1913. His father was a man called Michael Healy, who was actually a fairly affluent farmer. They had a farm of just over 100 acres in size in Ballyban, just outside what would now be a suburb of Galway City. At the time, it was basically the rural hinterland of Galway. It's very hard to know what his early life was like in Ireland, partly because of all this myth-making and partly because trying to also track down the childhood of a pretty obscure person could be quite difficult. He claimed that his father was shot and killed by the Black and Tans in 1919. We know exactly who was or was not killed throughout pretty much all of the Irish War of Independence, so we just know for a fact that that's not true. And then also he had brothers that were born in 1921. And certainly his father was still alive well into the 30s. Sometime in the late 20s, then he moved to Britain. So he's actually only about 13 or 14 years old when he moved. And why exactly he moved at that point is not clear, but something seemed to have gone wrong in his family in the late 20s. I think there were some financial problems in the family is something that I partially suspect based on the research I've done on him. And really from that point on, He is much more of a British figure than he is an Irish figure, although he always retains this connection to Ireland, and it became part of his persona to a certain degree.
Aidan, do we have any indication of what the family's politics were back in County Galway?
Not really at all. Not much evidence about, say, his father's having any kind of political connections. Because he's so circumspect about certain aspects of his early life, we don't know, for instance, were they members of Fianna Fáil? Were they members of Fine Gael? My suspicion really is that they were fairly apolitical, certainly not involved in things like Sinn Féin or anything like that. At least I've never seen evidence of that. And I think if there was, Gerry Healy would have exploited that. He did have a sister who became a nun, which is not totally unusual, obviously, in early 20th century Ireland. So they're certainly, I think, fairly conventional in their political beliefs and in their religious beliefs and social beliefs. But I wouldn't really want to speculate further than that.
What did he do once he got to England?
Well, if you believe him, he got involved in working on ships. And certainly there's some evidence that he did do that, but probably not as extensively as he would later claim. And he also, at a fairly young age, joined the Communist Party, which is, again, a not totally unusual thing at the time. The British Communist Party has a disproportionately large Irish membership in the late 20s, early 30s. It's a lot easier for Irish people to become communists in Britain than in Ireland itself. So he's certainly politically active in some ways and fairly loyal within the Communist Party. And then for reasons that, again, he engaged in a lot of myth-making about, he leaves the Communist Party probably in around 1937. He claimed that when he was working on ships as a merchant marine sailor, he was on a particular ship that had docked in Italy, and by this point is obviously a loyal member of the Communist Party, and saw Soviet ships delivering oil to fascist Italy at the height of the Spanish Civil War, came back to Britain, began to question why the Soviet Union was doing this, why support fascist Italy in the middle of the Civil War, and supposedly then was expelled from the Communist Party for asking those questions. As I was doing all this research, I came across a man called Jock Haston, who's a very leading figure on the British radical left in the late 30s, and by the late 30s is involved in Trotskyism. And he almost had the exact same experience, right? He was in Germany in the early 30s, was actually using his position as a merchant marine sailor to deliver secret messages to the Communist Party after Hitler has come to power, when communism is illegal, and saw that the Soviet Union still had trade links with Nazi Germany. And when he questioned this, was expelled from the Communist Party. So first of all, my suspicion is Gerry Healy stole that story. He basically just plagiarized this origin story for himself. But also Jock Haston told this later story in an interview that he did in the 1970s with some historians, where he said that he is actually the one who recruited Gerry Healy and convinced him to leave the Communist Party and join the Trotskyist movement. And that actually this was not some kind of high-minded anti-fascist thing. They actually got into a fight outside of a public toilet in Hyde Park in London. And it was shortly after that that Haston managed to convince Healy to join the Trotskyist movement. So a much less romantic story, a much less idealistic story, a kind of a squalid story, really.
And just one more question on the Irish angle of his origins. You know, so in Ireland itself, as you say, the Communist Party was basically illegal, but not quite illegal, but certainly persona non grata in Ireland in the 30s. And you had also a Republican kind of offshoot in Sarah Eyre and the Republican Congress. But in England, it strikes me that it's possible that being a communist might be a reaction to the harsh climate for our, you know, working class Irish immigrants in England. And also the Communist Party took a line on the Irish question, as it was known then, which was kind of Irish nationalist, so it would have attracted people that way. Would that have, mm-hmm. you know, would that have rubbed off on him, or any part of his formative years?
So I'll answer that in a very Trotskyist way. If we look at the early leaders of British Trotskyism, there's Gerry Healy. There is a man called Tony Cliff, whose real name is Yigal Gluckstein. And he is actually, he's Jewish. He came from Palestine. His parents were Zionists who had moved to Palestine prior to his birth. And then there's a man called Ted Grant, who is from South Africa. And those three people start three political traditions that are the three like main divisions within British Trotskyism. So none of them are British. And I just found that very curious as I was working on this. And I couldn't really figure out why. And my theory is kind of going close to what you're saying, that if you're Irish, you're not going to join the Conservative Party unless you are very, very ideologically conservative, because that's essentially an English nationalist party, and it's going to be off-putting. And there is this period in the 30s where the Labour Party is kind of a nationalist party too, and it has certain a kind of a social patriotism, I think it's sometimes called by scholars. And that might be a little bit off-putting too. And so maybe things like communism and Trotskyism become more attractive, because it's a way to be Irish, to be left-wing, but to not have to buy into English nationalism. And as you're pointing out, to be in a party that's actually quite sympathetic to republicanism. So I do think that's true for some people, but you still have the reality that most Irish people are actually joining the Liberal Party. That's where the vast majority of Irish immigrants go, or at least like the largest share are going. You are still talking about the Communist Party being, it's pretty small in Britain. It's not like places like France or Germany or Greece where Communist parties actually become quite large. That remains a quite small fringe party. And then Trotskyism on top of that is a fringe of a fringe. So I think trying to explain this in terms of like big social currents within the Irish community doesn't really work. Although I do want it to work because I think there is something there. There's not as much of a demographic to be able to prove that, I think.
Now, Aidan, we've mentioned the word a good few times at this stage, but what is Trotskyism and who was Leon Trotsky?
Sure, we'll maybe start with Trotsky himself and then move forward. If we go back to say 1917 to the first Russian Revolution, and this is all a little bit confusing because there are two revolutions in 1917. There's the February Revolution and the October Revolution. And as a lot of people might know, the February Revolution doesn't even happen in February. It happens in March. And the October Revolution happens in November because Russia still used an older calendar, the Julian calendar. So if you go back to February 1917, and in the immediate aftermath of that, Trotsky comes back to Russia and he gets involved in the ferment and uprisings that are happening in Russia following the February Revolution. And that's really a kind of an anti-war revolution. It's a revolution born out of the high cost of food, high cost of living in Russia in early 1917. But at that period, Leon Trotsky, he's of Ukrainian Jewish background, he's not a member of the Bolshevik party, of the same party as Lenin. He's a member of the Mensheviks, who are the other strand of Marxism in Russia. But in the period between February and October, Trotsky actually moves over and joins Lenin, joins the Bolshevik party, and he moves away from this position that the Mensheviks had had, which is there can be no socialist revolution yet in Russia. Russia's not ready for that yet. It must have a capitalist revolution first, and later on it can have a socialist revolution. And instead he sides with Lenin and argues that now is the time to actually seize a socialist revolution. Trotsky is a quite brilliant political theorist. He's a very brilliant military strategist. In some ways, he's a really terrible politician. So in this period prior to joining Lenin, he had made a lot of very, very bombastic statements about Lenin when they were on opposing sides of Russian Marxism. That's later going to come back and create some very serious problems for him. And as the revolution progresses after October 1917, he's involved in a lot of the military actions of the emerging Soviet Union. He's a leading figure within the Red Army, but he never really spots that there's this other person called Joseph Stalin, who is accruing a whole load of power within the early Soviet Union. Trotsky is completely dismissive of him, sees him as this ignorant Georgian peasant, doesn't take him seriously, and doesn't really realize that Stalin is actually outmaneuvering him politically. So that after Lenin dies, Trotsky essentially gets more and more isolated within the highest reaches of Soviet government. By the later 1920s, he is fully pushed out of the Soviet Union. First, he's internally exiled, and then later, at the very end of the decade, he's exiled first to Turkey, and he just kind of spends the rest of his life country hopping to anywhere that will take him, eventually ending up in Mexico. Now, in parallel to all of that, you have the Soviet Union encouraging socialists and radical leftists all around the world to form themselves into communist parties. And these are very much modeled on the type of party that had existed in the Soviet Union. They're quite centralized as organizations. They practice what they call democratic centralism, which is where in theory, there can be internal debate and democratic debate within the party. But once the party reaches a decision, everyone agrees to stick with that decision. That's the theory. The practice is really that decisions tend to be made more and more by central committees who control everything within the party, and rank and files just have to fall in line. So there are a number of people within these communist parties who start to be apprehensive about where communism is going. Certainly by the end of the 20s, they're getting a little bit worried about the type of party that communist parties are growing into. And I think then coming into the 1930s, it becomes harder and harder to ignore the fact that there are all these stories coming out of the Soviet Union about purges, about people being rounded up and arrested, and the fact that Trotsky, who was this very revered figure within the international socialist movement after 1917, now all of a sudden he's been sidelined and kicked out of the country and purged from the country. So a lot of these people start to actually look towards him as an inspiration. When he is being pushed aside by Stalin, when Trotsky is being pushed aside by Stalin, he leads a group that are usually called the left opposition. So that's kind of what Trotskyists see themselves as. They are the left-wing critics of Stalinism. And what quickly happens is that they are themselves pushed out of their respective communist parties, or they just leave. And they start forming their own alternative, still communist, but not Stalinist parties, is how they would see it. Although they're all still modeled on the same type of party that Lenin had favored. So still very centralized, fairly authoritarian, quite top-down, very rigid in their structures. So if you are a Trotskyist, you believe that you are the actual true heir of the legacy of the Russian Revolution. If you're a member of a regular communist party, if you're a Stalinist, as Trotskyists would call you, you just will tend to see Trotskyists as kind of a nuisance. They're what Lenin once called infantile ultra-leftists.
When does Trotskyism reach Britain and start to become organized politically?
So certainly by the early 30s, there are Trotskyist groups in Britain. The first one is called the Balham Group. Now, to put this into some perspective, it has 13 members. So you're not talking about a huge organization. It may have pretenses about someday, and this is quite true of a lot of Trotskyist parties, they might see themselves as the party that will someday lead the working class to its glorious revolution. They're often quite small, and they're also often quite schismatic. They tend to have divisions that harden quite easily into quite serious splits. So by the end of the 1930s, there are actually five separate Trotskyist organizations in Britain. None of them have more than 200 members. So these are quite small groups, certainly compared to the five-figure membership numbers that the Communist Party would have had by that point.
And that's something that we see internationally. In every country, there's usually one official Communist Party. But the multiplicity of Trotskyist groups in each, it's just insane. It's like Protestant sects. There's so many of them. It's almost impossible to keep track of them.
Yeah, I mean, and sometimes trying to figure out what exactly is the thing that has separated them is hard to know. The language you yourself are using there is a quite common one of seeing them like sects, seeing them like almost like religious movements. I'm a little bit apprehensive about that because I don't totally want to do that. And yet it's also kind of unavoidable. They do act in some ways like religious groups. They have sacred texts. They have this like iconic figure that they revere. There is almost like a veneration of their own failures in some ways. Like they see themselves almost like the martyrs of the left. And the divisions between them are very schismatic. They can be very aggressive. And yet when you kind of step back a little bit and you look at this, it might be that there's like 10 people in each group. Sometimes these are quite small groups. Usually they're a bit better in terms of their membership than just 10 people, but it's often quite small, yes.
Now, one thing we should say as well or get into is with the communist parties, obviously you have the Comintern and the Third International. What is the Trotskyist's answer to that to organize on an international basis?
So initially, that's quite an easy answer. There's a group just called the Fourth International. So if we look at this within the broader history of socialism, there's initially a thing called the Working Man's International that Karl Marx had founded, which later on is going to be referred to as the First International. That's replaced by what still exists today as the Socialist International, which is the international organization that most center-left groups are allied to. So like the Labour Party in Ireland, the Labour Party in Britain are allied to that. And then the Comintern will sometimes also call itself the Third International, with the idea that it will replace the Second International. And they have very serious criticisms of the Second International's support for the First World War. So unsurprisingly, Trotsky has become known as the Fourth International. So they're founded in 1938. They have a founding conference in France. Trotsky himself cannot attend. He's living in exile in Mexico and is unable to leave the country. but he does write their founding document, which is a very, very Trotskyist document. It's very bombastic. It's in some ways quite brilliant and also makes very, very bombastic predictions about the looming collapse of capitalism. That's in 1938. We're now in 2024. Obviously, that looming collapse hasn't happened yet. And initially, that's the umbrella organization for all global Trotskyist groups. And some of these groups are fairly impressive. Right? There's a group in the US in the 1930s called the Socialist Workers' Party, which is really the dominant group within the Fourth International. They have about 2,000 members in all of the US, and they get involved in some pretty serious things like strikes and things like that. But there's a lot of divisions that start to emerge within the Fourth International in the early 50s over debates started by a Greek-Egyptian Trotskyist called Michalis Raptas, who is also referred to as Michel Pablo, where he basically says it's time to actually start rebuilding our connections to the communist parties. And maybe we can also rebuild connections to social democratic parties. And what he's trying to do is get out of the funk that Trotskyism is in. It's not recruiting members. They're not really winning power anywhere. But within Trotskyism, this is seen as a heretical thing. And the Fourth International just fragments over this. And it essentially continues to fragment to this day. So now you will have not just individual small Trotskyist groups in every country, but they will all have their own Fourth International that they're affiliated to. So the International Committee for the Fourth International, the Unified Committee for the Fourth International, and so on and so on and so on.
I think the perception of Trotskyists, or the self-perception, was that they were in favor of, you know, the true, as you said, the true revolutionary gospel, to use the religious theme, and that they were in favor of, you know, permanent revolution and international revolution. And I think in the West, anyway, that, you know, a more democratic form of socialism than existed in the Soviet Union. But I mean, as a non-believer, I mean, I'm always struck by the contrast between Trotsky himself. I mean, the man who founded the Red Army effectively as a conscript force, militarization of labor and all this, you know, people from the former Soviet Union won't think of him in that way at all. They'll think of him as a hard man and militarist and so on. You know, is there a contradiction between the real Trotsky and what he did and Trotskyists and what they think it is?
You know, a lot of Trotskyists don't like to bring this up, but when they start really getting into this funk after World War II and realizing that they're not getting anywhere with this, Natalia Sadova, Trotsky's widow, makes this statement where she writes a letter to Trotsky and says, I do not recognize his politics in what you're doing, or words to that effect. I think there are some Trotskyists for whom it is a way of actually trying to critique Stalinism. And you're right that Trotskyists have a kind of a bad reputation. And I think that can be a little bit unfair. There are some really brilliant people who come out of this political tradition. The Socialist Workers Party in the US, which is not the same as the Socialist Workers Party in the UK, and that can be a confusing thing about Trotskyists. They tend to use very similar names, even if they're quite distinct or see themselves as quite distinct. But that group in the US is led by a man called James Cannon, who's an Irish-American, one of the founding members of the Communist Party. He's quite a brilliant person, quite an impressive person. There are people like Ernst Mandel, who's a Belgian political theorist. Ken Loach moves in Trotskyist circles in the 60s and 70s. Tariq Ali in Britain. A lot of these people are really smart and really perceptive, and they do produce really good intellectual work. And they're, I think, they're the good parts of the Trotskyist tradition. What I find a little bit maybe frustrating looking back at these groups is they have very good analyses of what's gone wrong in the Soviet Union, or I'd say fairly good. I wouldn't go all the way with what they say, but they tend not to ever turn that gaze back on themselves and say, well, should we look at how we're structuring our own parties? And that's where I think they really fail in a way. They don't develop an alternative form of very radical socialism that's also really democratic. I think one of the things I say in the book is that what I see as the political genius of Trotskyism is it allows you to do two things at once that might seem kind of contradictory or impossible. You can say, I support the Russian Revolution. I think that was a good thing. I think it's good that that Lenin staged a revolution and tried to bring about a socialist society, but I don't like where it ended up. And Stalinists can't do that because you have to accept that you are a supporter of the Soviet Union and you accept where the Soviet Union has ended up. The problem is that in terms of their day-to-day life, like the daily work of their parties, they are fairly similar to average communist parties in terms of being very rigid, very top-down, but they don't have all the good things that a communist party enjoys, say in the 30s and 40s. They can't point to the Soviet Union and say, that's a country that has avoided the depression. They don't have that international kind of that international glory that a communist party has.
Okay, so let's go back to Jerry Healey and the Workers'
Sure.
Revolutionary Party. Like, as you said, in its first decades, Trotskyism not terribly successful in Britain or anywhere else, pretty much. When does Trotskyism, and Jerry Healey in particular, become a figure of some kind of cultural importance and political importance in Britain?
So, you know, as I said, when we left him off, there were five different Trotskyist groups in Britain. They slowly unify through World War II. And they actually do some fairly impressive things. Once the Soviet Union enters the war, the Communist Party becomes a very patriotic pro-British party, essentially, it and refuses to support strikes and things like that. So there's a kind of a gap in the market, if you want to call it that, that Trotskyists can fill. So if you're working in a coal mine, or you're working in any kind of, you know, in any kind of place of employment, and you're not happy with your employer, the Communist Party will not give you support to go on a strike, and the Labour Party will not give you support to go on a strike during World War II, but Trotskyists will. And there's certain ways in which Trotskyists are actually kind of building themselves up a little bit during the war. And they come into the post-war period thinking, now is the time when there's going to be another revolutionary upsurge. This had been something that Trotsky had predicted at the end of the 30s, and they really stick to that. And it doesn't happen, right? Britain actually becomes very stable after the war. You get the welfare state and 5 years of a Labour government. America becomes very stable after World War II. So a lot of Trotskyists kind of go back into their, this is when they really start getting into a funk about what's the future going to hold for us. Jerry Healey's answer to this is that this unified Trotskyist group should actually enter the Labour Party, and within the Labour Party, try to push it towards the left and be, try to push it to be a genuinely radical socialist party. There's a very odd thing that happens with all of this. He leaves, and about 80 other people leave the Trotskyist party that he's a member of, called the Revolutionary Communist Party, and they enter the Labour Party as seemingly regular members of the Labour Party. Shortly after they do this, the Revolutionary Communist Party splits and dissolves, essentially. So they are the secretive wing of a party that no longer exists. And now they exist within the Labour Party. And they call themselves the club or the group. And they, all through the 50s, are active within the Labour Party. Healey at one point tries to run for Parliament. He's turned down for that. Some of them get elected as councillors. So they're a pressure group within the Labour Party. And they're well known within the Labour Party. They publish a newspaper for Labour Party members. And in some ways, ironically, this is probably his most, at least in terms of electoral politics, it's his most influential decade. But it's all happening through the Labour Party, which he sees as a reformist sellout party. At the end of the 1950s, the Labour Party starts to move a little bit to the right when Hugh Gaitskell becomes the leader of the Labour Party. And Hugh Gaitskell starts to basically clear out these people, these Trotskyists that he sees as troublemakers within the party. So in 1959, Jerry Healey forms an organization called the Socialist Labour League. And in real terms, this is the only Trotskyist political party that is properly active in Britain at the time. There are other Trotskyist groups, but they're essentially just debating societies. They don't have the proper organization that Healey and the Socialist Labour League have. So if you're involved in British politics, or you're just kind of politically conscious, and you're on the left, and you don't want to join the Labour Party because you see them as too moderate, you don't want to join the Communist Party because you see them as too dictatorial, your only real option is to join the Socialist Labour League. That's when you find, say, people like Ken Loach in the 1960s being a member of the Socialist Labour League briefly. There are people who leave the Communist Party in 1956 in quite large numbers after Nikita Khrushchev gives this very famous speech where he admits that all of Stalin's crimes were actually real and they weren't just disinformation being put out by the West. About 200 of those people joined the Socialist Labour League. So they're a known presence on the British left, but certainly not like a major force. And they don't contest elections. They're just involved in trade union activism and things like that.
Now, Aidan, the two Trotskyist groups that, with a background in Britain, that people in Ireland would be most familiar with are the Socialist Workers' Party, which is the main part of People Before Profit in Ireland, and also the old Militant Tendency, or the Socialist Party, the party of Joe Higgins, that people will remember. How did they fit in to this milieu of Trotskyism in Britain at the time?
So if we start with Militant, as they're later known, they're founded really by a man called Ted Grant, who is there in the 1930s in Trotskyism with Gerry Healy, is essentially forced out of the Revolutionary Communist Party by Gerry Healy at the end of the 40s, and forms a group eventually called the Revolutionary Socialist Party. And the names obviously can get a little bit confusing because they all are essentially just a combination of the same finite list of words. The Revolutionary Socialist Party are fairly active on the left wing of British politics, but they in some ways pick up this idea that Healy had of entryism, that you should enter into the Labour Party. And that's effectively when they become the Militant Tendency. The Socialist Workers' Party come out of a party that used to be called the International Socialists, founded by a man called Tony Cliff, or Yigal Gluckstein, to use his real name. And they really have a lot of successes at the end of the 60s. And then in the 1970s, they changed their name to the Socialist Workers' Party. The end of the 60s until maybe the mid-1980s is really the golden age of British Trotskyism. There's maybe about 20,000 people active in Trotskyist parties in Britain in that period. So they're actually larger in total number than the Communist Party, but now split over multiple different groups. And then there's also a group active at that time called the International Marxist Group, the Tariq Ali, the song Street Fighting Man by the Rolling Stones is about. He's a very active member in that. And they publish a really good newspaper called Black Dwarf that's sort of half Trotskyist, half a kind of counterculture, you know, slightly hippie-ish newspaper. A lot of these groups really benefit from anti-Vietnam War protests, from student protests and things like that. And their numbers start to really go up. And that's when they really start to eclipse the Socialist Labour League and become a little bit more important than them, and certainly a bit more prominent. But this is happening at a time when Britain seems to be getting a lot more unstable politically. There's a whole load of very serious strikes going on all through the early 70s. You have the Troubles in Northern Ireland starting in 1969. Britain seems to be on the verge of some big transformation. So for Trotskyists, they would call this a pre-revolutionary situation. And that's when Gerry Healy changes the name of his group from the Socialist Labour League to the Workers' Revolutionary Party, which he then is the leader of until 1985. Which at least within Trotskyism, that's his most important period when he leads that group.
And what's so distinctive about Gerry Healy and his group?
So even before he founds this group, he has a bad reputation on the British left. They're seen as very, very sectarian. To a certain degree, all of the Trotskyist groups are guilty of that. They tend to dislike each other in some ways. It can sometimes seem more than they dislike their actual political enemies. But the Socialist Labour League and then later the WRP are very, very sectarian. They are, even by the usual standards of Trotskyism, very authoritarian. And Healy has a very well-established reputation for physical violence. One of the people who leaves the Communist Party and goes into the Socialist Labour League is a man called Brian Behan, who's Brendan Behan's brother. He starts to criticize Gerry Healy, and Gerry Healy has him assaulted. There's a man called Ernie Tate, who's a member of another Trotskyist group, who is selling pamphlets from his group outside of a Socialist Labour League meeting in the mid-60s. And from all accounts, it seems that Gerry Healy essentially ordered some of his members to go over and really violently beat him, and they eventually end up hospitalizing him. So he has a quite nasty reputation. And yet, I think for some people, that becomes a kind of an attractive thing. That almost becomes like a recruiting tool. If you believe that a revolution is coming in Britain, then this like very macho posturing that they engage in, this kind of hard man image that he's cultivating through this violence, that becomes almost kind of attractive, right? You want to be a member of a party that can carry out tough actions like that. They are a party, let's say, coming into the 1970s, when he founds this group called the Workers' Revolutionary Party. There's a lot of curious things about how many assets they appear to have. And that starts to attract a lot of attention from other people on the radical left in Britain. They have maybe 3,000 members in total. They claim that they have 8,000 members, but that's probably an exaggeration. So they have about 3,000 active, genuine, fees-paying members. And yet they seem to be able to build up way more of an infrastructure as a party that they have any than they have any real business being able to do, given their size. So they own, say, throughout the 1970s, they acquire a large 8-bedroom mansion in Derbyshire that they use for weekend retreats. They open a newspaper, a daily newspaper called Newsline. It is actually the first ever full-color daily paper in Britain, not just of a socialist group, but of any newspaper in the country. They own their own full-color printing press in a place called Runcorn in the north of England, in Merseyside. They own a network of bookshops around the country. They later on acquire a network of youth training centers in different cities, mainly, you know, deindustrializing cities. They own a number of apartments in London and then also a headquarters. And that starts to prompt a whole load of what are basically conspiracy theories about the party. Like, where are they getting this money from to do all this? So the most convenient explanation is that the Libyan government is paying for this. And there's a lot of very outlandish stories that start to be told about them, which are not totally made up. In fact, there's quite a lot of truth to them. In 1977, the party issues a joint statement with the Libyan government announcing their shared commitment to fight against imperialism and Zionism. Probably they're getting some money from the Libyan government, probably five-figure sums at the time. They also are using their printing press to actually print newspapers for the Libyan government and both English language publications that the Gaddafi government are using to publicize themselves internationally, as well as Arabic language newspapers that are being sold in Libya. There are similar accusations from about 1979 onwards that they're getting money from the Iraqi government. And that one I'm more confident in saying is fairly fabricated. There's probably some small amounts of cash being given over, but nothing major. And in all of these cases, in both of these cases, I think what's also happening is that the WRP themselves are actually actively promoting these stories, because it creates this image that they are a party with really extensive international connections to seemingly anti-imperialist forces in Libya, in Iraq. I think the sadder truth is that where they're getting most of this money from is they're just sweating it out of their members. If you join, you are expected to hand over very large amounts of money. I've talked to members who would be expected to, you know, in carrying out this research, I interviewed a lot of former members. I spoke to one former member who said he was handing over his unemployment benefits to the party. The printing press that they own outside of Liverpool in Merseyside, this is a kind of a rare kind of bit of humor about them. They actually partly build that with a grant from the British government to start a business in an area of high unemployment. It probably didn't actually provide a lot of employment because its party members actually doing most of the work. So they're a party that are very, very bombastic in their rhetoric, very ultra-leftist, constantly talking about a revolution is just around the corner, and have some very shady international connections.
Now, Aidan, that's something I'd like to pursue with you there in terms of the membership. That, as you said there, you did interview a lot of former members. You've gone through a lot of the archives. What was life like for your average member of the Workers' Revolutionary Party?
So I might come back to that word average, because there's average members and then there's some not average members who get a very different treatment. But if you're like a regular grassroots member, let's say in London, in Cardiff, in Manchester, it really, once this daily paper starts in the mid 70s, that's kind of the central thing that you're doing as a party member. So they're printing this newspaper in the north of England, and then it has to be brought around the country. Every other daily national paper in Britain pretty much is printed in London to be then distributed from there. They have this curious setup where it's being printed in the north and then has to be brought south. And they're doing that because essentially they got that grant to set up the printing press there. So you might get up at 4 a.m, drive across the country to some place on a motorway to meet a lorry coming down from Liverpool. You'll pick up copies of the paper, you'll bring it back down to London or to Cardiff or to wherever, and you'll stand outside the post office or outside tube station or whatever it is, selling copies of this paper. Most of the members will have a full-time job, so then you'll go to your full-time job, you'll work that all day, and then in the evenings you'll be expected to go out and sell more papers or go to a branch meeting, things like that. There are about 90 people, which again is quite an inflated number for a party this size, and it's curious where they're getting the money from to pay all these people, but there's about 90 people who work full-time for the party. I spoke to one former member who, when I asked him, you know, were you a full-time worker? And he said, no, I was lucky enough to be able to avoid that, because your life is just the party now. You don't have a job. You have very little private life. There's a good chance you actually live on premises owned by the party, right? You live in an apartment, in a flat owned by the party. You might actually be sharing your bed with another party member who works at night. So you sleep in the bed at night, they sleep in the bed during the day. So it's a very like totalizing organization. Your entire life is given over to this organization. You will be expected, once they acquire this mansion in Derbyshire, you're expected to go there once a year for a weekend retreat, or maybe even longer than a weekend. Maybe you'll be there for a week or two. A lot of the people I spoke to said that going to that house was actually quite a terrifying experience. It seemed to me this quite lonely, isolated building in a very rural part of Britain. And once you get there, you will be attending, you know, extensive classes of Marxist education. Now, some of them are actually going to be quite good. And there are party members I spoke to who said some of these classes are like they remember them very, very fondly. There's a man called Cliff Slaughter, who's a sociologist at Leeds University. He would teach some of them. And there are a few other academics like that in the party who seem to have actually provided a good level of education for party members. Now, obviously, it's education in Marxist classics and things like that. But a lot of former members would then say, once Gerry Healy would show up at that house, the mood would change. It would become much more foreboding, much less of an open feeling. Healy would give these really interminable 3 and 4 hour long lectures on what he claimed was a kind of Hegelian philosophy, like a philosophy drawn from Hegel, who's an early 19th century German philosopher, and is in some ways a kind of precursor to Karl Marx. A lot of former members then would tell me that after they would attend these lectures that Healy would give, they would have no idea, like, what was he actually talking about? They would remember as being this incredibly profound lecture that he gave, and yet couldn't take ideas from it. And what I've come to think about that, and I think it says something bigger about the type of organization it was and what it meant to join this, is that what Healy was really doing was giving lectures that were essentially nonsensical in the most literal sense of the word. They were meaningless. He was saying nothing of any philosophical value. But what he was doing was creating a kind of shared language that the party could use. And it's a language that can then be used to denounce anyone and everything because it means nothing. So he would take all these concepts that are genuine philosophical concepts like ontology, epistemology, pragmatism, idealism, but they just function as kind of slurs, right? Anyone that disagrees with Gerry Healy is an idealist or is a pragmatist or is being subjective rather than objective. They're not embracing his objective understanding of the dialectic. So it's a lot of buzzwords that I don't think he actually really understood in any real philosophical sense, but he knows how to use them as a kind of organizational tool. So once you criticize him, at best, you'll be denounced using this language. And this is one of the places where they start to actually become less of a political party and more of a cult. And I've always been a bit hesitant about calling them a cult because you start kind of pathologizing the people that are members and seeing them as like lost souls who need to be saved or something like that. But a lot of the former members I spoke to, when I said, you know, a question kind of like what you're asking, like, what was it like to be a member? Like, I would often start by asking, tell us just, you know, is there any just anecdotes you'd like to start with that just exemplify what it was like to be in this group? And in many, many cases, and probably in a majority of the cases, they would say at some point like that it was a cult and I was a member of a cult. And if the membership themselves are remembering it as being a cult-like organization, I think you have to take that seriously. And there are ways in which it's very, very cult-like, right? This insular language that outsiders can't understand, that's a classic archetype of a, that's a classic trait of a cult. The fact that you have to give over more and more money all the time, the fact that you have to give over more and more of your life, and you're expected to cut off connections with your family if they won't join, this is almost clichédly cult-like.
Well, Aidan, you at the start of your answer there, you said not all members are the same. Now, one of the things about the WRP it was famous for was some of its celebrity members. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. So I'll maybe go back to the 1960s. At the end of the 1960s, there are a few people involved in the theater world, in the film world, in London, who start hosting what are essentially intellectual parties. And these are people like Ken Loach, Corin Redgrave, actors, directors, and generally on the left politically. They don't want to join the Labour Party because they see it as too reformist, too moderate. They don't want to join the Communist Party because they can see all the problems of joining a dictatorial party like that. So they start having these parties where they will invite people from these growing Trotskyist groups, or also just interesting intellectuals. So people like Alistair MacIntyre, who's a person who's kind of promoting the use of psychology and philosophy in Britain at the time, they invite him. And they start inviting people like Gerry Healy. So Healy starts showing up at these parties and he actually starts recruiting some members. One of which is Corin Redgrave, who's maybe not a very well-remembered person today, and in some ways is somewhat unfairly remembered because of his more famous father and his more famous sister. So Corin Redgrave joins. He's an actor, and he joins claiming that he wants to get involved in a left-wing group, but he doesn't want to get involved in something that he sees as kind of soft, like the hippies. Like he wants to be in a hard group, and that's often the language that he uses. His wife at the time, Deirdre Redgrave, later writes a memoir about what it was like to live with him, and they get divorced shortly after he joins the WRP, or he joined the SLL, which then became the WRP. When he joined, supposedly Gerry Healy announced to a lot of other members that the person he really wanted to get was Corin Redgrave's sister, Vanessa Redgrave. So she's really coming out as like a very, very prominent actor at the time, right? Aside from the fact that her father, Michael Redgrave, is a very well-known person in the theater world, she has a starring role in the film The Devils at the end of the 60s, which is a really like harrowing but also very brilliant film. And she gives an absolutely amazing performance in that. And Healy and Corin Redgrave really, it seems, start to badger her to join. And eventually she gives in early 1973, just as the SLL is about to become the Workers' Revolutionary Party. And there's a lot of evidence that, I mean, first of all, she throws herself very completely into this and becomes a very active member. But there's also a lot of evidence that if you wanted to start a theatre career in Britain and you wanted Vanessa Redgrave to give her help to you, you would be expected to join the WRP. So there's a lot of theatre people start to move into the world of the Workers' Revolutionary Party. There's a joke at the time that WRP actually stands for West End Revolutionary Party because there's so many actors going into the party. And some of this is made fun of by as a joke like that suggests. Some of it is serious, right? And I don't doubt their commitment to joining this group. There are times when the WRP starts getting involved in union activism within Equity, within the Actors Union. And then they start getting Vanessa Redgrave to run for election for them. And it truthfully, it goes very badly. She runs twice in 1974. There are two general elections in 1974 in Britain. She gets something like 400 or 500 votes each time. And then in 1978, she runs in a by-election in Manchester, again, does very, very badly. The National Front get about twice her vote. I think she gets something in the 300s. Even by 1978, when she's an Oscar-winning actress by that point, her celebrity doesn't really do anything for the party.
Well, I can remember watching some footage, and I can't remember from which election it was from, but for the people listening, there was a convention in British politics when the presiding officer is reading out the results to all the candidates stand, and they all make speeches, and they all stand there respectfully listening to each other. Apart from the National Front, the far right fascist party, all the other candidates would leave the stage. And they did that with Vanessa Redgrave too, whether I can't remember which one it was, but I definitely remember seeing her making her speech afterwards, and everyone just moves out, and it's a really violent type of like the country's on the state of collapse. Did you ever see that one?
I did. So that's from one of her elections in 1974. And you can actually hear, like, as they're announcing the election results, the Labour candidate wins with tens of thousands of votes. And then they come to Vanessa Redgrave, and she's got something in the region of 400 votes. And you can hear the audience just burst out laughing. And she gives this very, very bombastic speech, as you're saying then, right, about like, we were the only party that stood on a socialist platform, and we will stand with the working class. And you can actually hear people like slow clapping to essentially shut her up. So I think initially, for her, this is, it's a little bit of an embarrassment for her career, but I think the quality of her acting allowed her to get away with this, essentially. People would just kind of ignore this side of her. For Corinne Redgrave, I think it probably did stall his acting career. And there's a long period where he both doesn't act and is actually working full time for the party. When these people join, they're not put under the same kind of pressure that a regular grassroots member would be put under. Although Redgrave did go out and sell the party newspaper quite regularly, which must have been a quite surreal thing to be like walking to work one morning and Vanessa Redgrave is, an Oscar-winning actress is selling you a Marxist newspaper. They're generally fast-tracked into leadership positions within the party. And Healey, I think, was quite systemic in what he was doing. He knew how to flatter their egos. They would be allowed to teach classes at the college and things like that. So they're treated like very, very serious intellectuals, whatever else they may have been. And I think that's part of how Healey has managed to pull some of these people in also.
Now, one thing to mention, when we were growing up in Ireland in the late 80s, 90s, and you're looking at older British television and films and just current affairs from the 70s, one thing, and the 80s too, one thing that's quite apparent compared to today is politics and ideology are regularly discussed, that you'll see things like films talking about, or and dramas, TV dramas as well, talking about socialism and discussing it. It's very much part of the milieu, and we're in a like a post-ideology world now, and particularly with things like drama and film, it's nowhere near like you mentioned Ken Loach there and Kathy Come Home and GBH in the 80s about Trotskyism, and then even into the 90s, Our Friends in the North. That when you're looking over Britain, and we're getting British television over in Ireland and British films, it's very much part of the public conversation.
I mean, they are part of this moment in the 1970s, and this kind of surge of Trotskyism in the 1970s is part of a time when there were just a lot more unionized workers in Britain. It's easy in some ways, and maybe like it's something you always have to try and avoid, I think, when you're doing a project like this or researching a topic like this. You don't want to be dismissive of these people, right? There's 3,000 members at any one time in the WRP. But it's never the same 3,000, and the level of membership turnover is quite high. And if you're to really like, if we could somehow get access to membership statistics, which groups like this tend not to make public, so I was never able to do that in like a really empirically verifiable way. But if you could, my kind of educated guess would be that tens of thousands of people moved through the orbits of Gerry Healy over the years, like from the period from the late 40s until 1989 when he dies. There are a few different, there's like four different groups that he's a leader of. And these people did see this as a real option or as a real possibility. I don't know if we're in a post-ideological age or just a post-Marxist age, but certainly Marxism was a lot more possible, a lot more respected in mainstream culture than it might be today.
I mean, the other backdrop to this, of course, was, in the 70s, there was famously a lot of strikes in Britain, also in Ireland for the same reason, which was inflation really was the big thing. And then the 80s, obviously, the big set piece defeats of the labor movement in Britain, the miners' strike and the press and so on. I mean, against this background, what influence did the WRP actually have politically? I mean, okay, they did very badly in elections. But politically, culturally, what influence do they have? Because the reason that I ask about strikes is I mentioned this to you before we started recording, Aidan, recently read a book about the miners' strike in 1984-85, and it says Arthur Scargill, the leader of the miners' union, National Union of Mine Workers, the only newspaper he was prepared to help or to talk to was Newsline, which was the newspaper of the WRP. So despite the terrible election results, like what influence did they have in this period?
So if we go back to, let's say, when the party is founded, when you have this, you know, big wave of strikes in the early 70s, I mean, they're founded as a party rather than a league to take advantage of what they see as this upsurge of labor militancy in Britain. There's a very notorious factory in Britain called British Leyland in Oxford, which has a, for people who are very hostile to unions, sort of early versions of Thatcherites, they see British Leyland as like everything that is wrong with British industry, right? Unions are too powerful. They're too strike prone, too militant. The shop steward in British Leyland is a man called Alan Thornett, is a member of the Workers' Revolutionary Party. So they have an influence there, but in classic WRP style, within a year of the founding, they expel Alan Thornett and about 100 to 200 people leave with him. So in a group that's only maybe 3,000 people at most, losing 200 members and 200 union members in a factory, right, that's not good. And I think this kind of general upsurge of Trotskyism is bound up with that upsurge of labor militancy in the early 70s. And when it really starts to crack is in the mid 80s. And I don't think that's a coincidence that, say, the militant tendency in the Labour Party in Britain is essentially purged by Neil Kinnock and the Labour leadership in the first half of the 1980s. The International Marxist Group, this other Trotskyist group, they fragment in 1983 and right after that. And then in 1985, the WRP goes through an incredibly dramatic split as a party. When the miner strike happens, what's kind of odd for the WRP about that is they had constantly been talking about like a revolution is just around the corner. And again, like it can be hard to forget how dangerous the miner strike is from the perspective of the British establishment. It could have very easily, it seemed at the time at least, like it could very easily go in the other direction to where it ended up, where Scargill could actually carry out the beginnings of a revolution in the country, right? There's a lot of instability. And yet the WRP kind of stepped back from that a little bit. And I think there's very specific reasons to do with them as a political organization, why they do that. They're very, very suspicious of grassroots political activism. So when you get things like, you know, all of these things that are now like kind of romanticized about the miner strike, like gays and lesbians support the miners and, you know, organizations for the wives of coal miners where they're organizing relief efforts and things like that. The WRP see that as like very suspicious because it's not happening within the confines of a correct, you know, Bolshevik style party with the proper leadership of someone like Gerry Healy. So they tend to actually not give any support to that, which, to be totally honest, really annoys the members that they do have in the National Union of Mine Workers. What they're much more interested in is building connections with people like Arthur Scargill. There's a kind of an elitism about them as a party at that period. So they're just way more interested in the union leadership than in the union rank and file.
Just one more quick question, which is about the Irish context again. So another thing that's going on in the United Kingdom state, of course, is the Troubles, the conflict in Northern Ireland. And, you know, the British left had various attitudes to it. You know, the Labour Party's in power quite a lot of the time. Communist Party's kind of lukewarm on it. Some of the Trotskyist groups are very pro-Republican, Irish Republican. What stance did the WRP have, given that both they and the Provisional IRA were both denied from Colonel Gaddafi at the time?
Yeah, so I don't think they both knew about that shared connection at the time. So when the Troubles do break out in 1969, they're initially like very, very critical of the idea of British troops being dispatched to Northern Ireland. And there's various times where they publish things that are in tone, in rhetoric, are like completely indistinguishable from the kind of thing that Sinn Féin or the Provisional IRA would have published at the time, right? Very nationalistic, kind of ultra-republican accounts of Irish history, you know, seeing the IRA as acting in the tradition of Connolly and Pearse and Emmett and Tone and that kind of thing. There's an organization, which maybe is what you're referring to when you say Trotskyists are fairly like sympathetic to republicanism. There's an organization in Britain called the Troops Out Movement, which is essentially a lot of Trotskyists coming together. It's one of the few times when they're actually willing to cooperate. The Troops Out Movement newspaper is printed by the WRP at their facility in Runcorn, is sold in their bookshops. When the Birmingham and Guildford bombings happen, the WRP, like a lot of Trotskyist groups, actually issue statements condemning this and saying, and they do it in very Trotskyist ways. They draw on this piece that Trotsky had written years earlier called On Terrorism, where he says that individual acts of terrorism will never bring about a socialist revolution, and therefore we condemn this. The IRA issue a very, very sarcastic statement in response, where they say, well, isn't it a shame that the great socialist revolution is now not going to happen in Britain because of us? Because if it wasn't for us, you know, if we got out of the way, all of these Trotskyist groups would finally have their socialist revolution. And they just kind of dismiss them. They dismiss the Trotskyist groups. In general, I think the provisional IRA tends to be very apprehensive about this Trotskyist support, partly because it is often people like Vanessa Redgrave. These, you know, there's a tradition of, there's a certain presence of more upper middle class English people in these groups. And that doesn't necessarily sit well with the leadership of the IRA. And the IRA sees that these groups tend to be very schismatic, tend to be quite bombastic in their rhetoric, maybe is not bringing the best kinds of police attention and things like that. So in general, the IRA keeps them at a distance and kind of knows to keep them at a distance too.
There's one strange one, though, which I'm sure you've come across. It's a small group called Red Action, which some of their members seem to have actually joined the IRA in the 90s.
I've come across them a little bit. I don't know a huge amount about them, though, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're mostly of Irish origin, and they were kind of street fighters against the National Front and stuff in the, I think, the Socialist Workers' Party or whichever group, whatever. Very, like, I mean, 100% on message for provisional. So
yeah,
but like two of them were actually convicted. Like they were caught trying to do a bombing in the 90s, I think, during the breakdown and ceasefire period. But anyway, I digress.
Now, Aidan, we have to get to towards the end of this story and the downfall of Gerry Healy. How does that come about?
So it's pretty shocking. You know, as I said a few minutes ago, his party had a bad reputation well before this, right? Even going back to the 1960s. And then they have all of these assets, all of which cost money. The newspaper is being printed daily. They are trying to sell about 8,000 copies a day, which is actually, I mean, pretty impressive for a small group. But mainly that newspaper is a loss-making enterprise. So there's a lot of financial problems in the organization in the early 80s. And there's basically a group of about five people who are all full-time workers for the party, who recognize that this financial problem is looming and that actually the party is on the verge of bankruptcy. They tried to talk to Gerry Healy about this. He would actually just have like very aggressive temper tantrums when people would try to raise financial issues with him and would refuse to talk about this. And then two of the members, a woman named Aileen Jennings and a woman named Claire Cowan, they start having private conversations where they both realize that, and it's hard to know what exact word to use for this, but they both were having sexual relationships with Gerry Healy. Somewhat consensually, somewhat non-consensually. They're both a lot younger than Gerry Healy. By the early 80s, I mean, he's into his early 70s. And he is the leader of, you know, a very, very authoritarian organization where he has a lot of power and authority. And then the more that these two women talk, the more they realize that there's actually quite a lot of other women like this. So very tentatively and cautiously, they start trying to identify other members of the party that are critical of Healy, as well as other women in the party that have been targeted, who have essentially been coerced into having sex with Healy. And then in the summer of 1985, Aileen Jennings hands a letter to the political committee of the Workers' Revolutionary Party, which is really the centralmost body within the party that runs the party. And it's made up of Healy, a lot of his closest supporters. Both of the Redgraves are on this committee. And the letter, in fairly blunt language, names the fact that Healy has had this very long history of sexual abuse. Going back to 1964, as it mentions in the letter, there had been an incident within the Socialist Labour League, as it was called at the time, where something had happened, and it's a bit circumspect about this, but what I found out in the course of my research is that a female member of the party, Healy, had essentially sexually harassed her, and had an investigation had been carried out within the party of this, and Healy had agreed that he would cease these activities, which is the phrase that's used in the letter. So high-ranking members of the party knew that Healy was doing this, that he had this history of sexual abuse. And in the letter itself, there are 26 different women named as women that had been targeted by Gerry Healy. Every single version of the letter that I've ever seen, those 26 names are redacted, either because the organizations that published them redacted them at the time, or if you go to look at them now in archives for reasons of British privacy law, they will be redacted, or you won't even get to see the letter in the first place. So initially, this is treated as a kind of a provocation within the party. The people around Healy essentially close ranks initially, or they at least try to, and they try to suppress the information from coming out. But the letter starts to circulate within the membership of the WRP. Initially, Healy agrees that he will cease any contact with young people or with young women. He then agrees that he will retire from the party, and then eventually it's actually agreed that he'll be expelled from the party. So there's an incredibly charged and emotive meeting where huge numbers of the membership of the party come together in London in October of 1985. And essentially the two sides kind of face off against each other, either people who want Healy to go and their supporters, or the lingering supporters of Healy himself. Healy doesn't come to the meeting because he's actually been expelled from the party by this point. One of the leading members of the party, a man called Mike Banda, gives this incredibly long speech for like a multi-hour speech where he goes into very painstaking detail about acts of sexual abuse Healy had carried out. And what I suggest in the book is that what he was effectively doing was tacitly admitting that he knew about this all along, and that's why he had all this information. All members of the party are told that they are not to speak about this to other Trotskyist groups or to the bourgeois press, as they call it. And then inevitably it starts to leak out. So there are initially some articles, very like kind of blandly worded articles, start to appear in The Guardian and other more highbrow British newspapers, just saying the long-standing leader of the Workers' Revolutionary Party has resigned from the party. And then a couple of days after that, the floodgates essentially open, and the British tabloid press just go to town on this in a very nasty way. They write these articles about, they treat it almost like a joke or like a kind of a titillating story about this, you know, pensioner having sex with young women, completely ignoring the factors of sexual abuse that are going on in this. The two Redgraves actually side with Healy. I mean, there's a very notorious statement that multiple different people have told me they remember Corin Redgrave saying, where at a particular party meeting, he recounted all of Gerry Healy's achievements in building this party, building the newspaper, and then said, if this is the work of a rapist, we should recruit more rapists. The people who support Healy essentially say either these are just the kind of peccadilloes of a leader and we should be okay with that, or they say this is all a myth, none of this happened. The problem with them claiming that is that Healy had actually signed a confession saying that he did this and that he would agree to not do it in the future, and that's obviously a fairly incontrovertible piece of evidence that the opposing side can throw back in his face and back in the face of people like Vanessa and Corin Redgrave. So the WRP essentially fractures into six separate parties, two of which continue to call themselves the Workers' Revolutionary Party. Initially, there are different versions of Newsline being published, some saying Gerry Healy has been expelled for sexual abuse, and some saying, essentially denying that this is going on. And Healy essentially disappears from public life for several months, slowly starts to come back into public life, will do things like attend a theater with Vanessa Redgrave, and then forms a party in 1987 called the Marxist Party, which is the last political party that he leads. It is very, very Healyist, right? Incredibly top down, incredibly hard to join. You have to join as a provisional member and essentially be like judged suitable over a 6 month period and things like that. And then in late 1989, Healy suffered a heart attack. He had already had heart problems going back to the early 80s and died soon after that. He was cremated and buried in Highgate Cemetery, so not that far from where Karl Marx is buried. And suitably enough, given like the very fractious nature of the politics that he had spent his life being involved with, there were actually protests by other Trotskyist groups at his funeral.
That sounds very on brand. Now, you talked there about the WRP splitting in six different factions. In terms of their international affiliates, and particularly in the States, how did the fall of Healy affect them?
So oddly, the American, they have this American affiliate called the Workers League, which is led at that time by a man called David North. And he had actually been criticizing Healey from the early 80s, particularly about this kind of nonsensical pseudo philosophy that Healey would engage in. When North tries to like circulate those criticisms, the rest of the party essentially shut him down and he stops. But then he starts up again as you're coming up towards 1985 and towards his split. Although he wouldn't have known anything about Eileen Jennings and Clare Cowan moving against Healey within the party. He shows up in the midst of all this in October of 85 and starts trying to demand that the British membership should put themselves under his leadership and that he would rectify the party. To be totally blunt about that, one former WRP member said to me, like, we had just gotten rid of one dictator. We all just told him to fuck off, right? We didn't want this person taking over. And in many ways, what David North tries to do is to really scale down all of these stories of sexual abuse and make this a fight about abstract issues of Trotskyist politics, and essentially not have a debate about what had actually happened in terms of sexual abuse and what had gone wrong with the party that it had allowed this to happen. A very small number of the British membership do side with North. The vast majority of members within Britain go to what's called the Workers' Revolutionary Party Workers' Press, which is the name of the newspaper that they have, led by Cliff Slaughter, this professor of sociology at Leeds University, which stays active as a group into the early 90s. It's actually involved in some pretty impressive stuff in delivering aid to people in Bosnia after the breakup of Yugoslavia. But like a lot of radical left groups, it finds it hard to adjust to a life after the end of the Soviet Union. And by the early 90s, it collapses as a group. The American group still exists, and it's one of the last kind of remnants of Healyist Trotskyism. And there is still a political party in Britain that calls itself the Workers' Revolutionary Party and still publishes a daily paper, which I have heard somewhat harshly and cruelly called the lowest circulation daily paper in the world.
And Aidan, did you study the history of this party and Gerry Healy as emblematic of something wider, or is the story in itself important?
If I'm being totally honest, I'm interested in the history of socialism. I'm from Galway. I knew about Gerry Healy and I just thought, like, I'd like to know more about him. And so even slightly before the pandemic, I was starting to just gather some things about him, thinking like, okay, this will be something. It'll be some kind of piece of writing will come out of this. And as the pandemic just kept going, I just kept doing research and it just kept growing and growing. A good and bad thing about Trotskyists is that they produce a lot of literature, and they put most of it on the internet. So you can find it pretty easily. So, during lockdown, it was pretty easy for me to get access to this stuff. So my initial motivation was just I thought this was an interesting story about a socialist from Galway. There are two, I think, slightly more important motivations that kind of emerged as I was doing all this. One is a kind of a methodological problem that this book kind of poses, which is Trotskyists, as I say, they produce a lot of material and they're very, very schismatic. And they tend to, when they split, they don't just have an amicable divorce, they completely denounce each other. So when you're studying all of these things, like accusations that Gerry Healy was violent or accusations, very, very well-founded accusations that he was a sexual abuser, there's actually completely divergent versions of the truth. And that's just, I think, methodologically interesting as a historian. Like, how do you tell the truth when the people you're studying can't even agree on what truth is? And then I think the other hopefully more serious motivation that emerged was I do think that this story says something about very top-down authoritarian organizations, particularly about Leninist style parties, where there's a central committee, there's a leader, that leader is revered, that leader is not allowed to be criticized. And I do think an organization like that, whether it's political or religious or anything else, that's an organization that is almost incubating abusers. So I think it's a kind of a cautionary tale to actually go and study this organization and see why it ended up so badly.
And just as an epilogue, I mean, you mentioned in your book and in an interview that you did with Jacobin, the American magazine, that 1989, ironically, and the end of communism sunk the British Trotskyist left.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Ireland, they actually emerged in the 1990s in the post-Cold War period. As a kind of an epilogue, can you just say something about that?
Sure. So in you know, I've written another thing for Saher, the Irish Labour History Journal, about just kind of an odd thing I came across in the course of my research called the Irish Trotskyist Treatise, or the Treatise of the Irish Trotskyists. I've seen different titles being used for it. And it's this like very, very bombastic, but also really smart analysis of Ireland in the 1940s, written by the first ever Irish Trotskyist group. And in the little introduction that I wrote for that, I talked about this kind of curious phenomenon where Trotskyism has generally declined everywhere, but in Ireland it has lingered on. And there's a couple of other places in the world where Trotskyism has actually done pretty well politically. And the classic example of this is Sri Lanka. There's a Trotskyist party established in Sri Lanka before a communist party, and that doesn't really happen elsewhere. And essentially what happened there is that that party, that Sri Lankan Trotskyist party, the Lanka Sama Samaja party, they were able to fill a gap in the political system, essentially, that nobody else was filling. There was no other radical left party. So if you're politically radical left, you vote for the Trotskyists. And by the time the Communist Party gets established in Sri Lanka, it's kind of too late for them, right? The Lanka Sama Samaja party has already like gained a foothold. What I think has happened in Ireland is that when the Workers' Party went into decline, and really, you know, went into decline because of 1989 and because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, when the Workers' Party went into decline in Ireland, that opened up a gap in Irish politics that people like Joe Higgins and Richard Boyd Barrett and Paul Murphy were able to fill. The other thing that I would take from that party in Sri Lanka is, and this is again quite unusual for a Trotskyist party, they're very pragmatic. They work with radical nationalists. They work with more moderate leftists like social democrats. They've been in government in coalition with other forces. So they kind of moderate their Trotskyism, basically. And they are actually eventually expelled from the Fourth International for not being Trotskyist enough. And I think when you look at groups like People Before Profit, they don't do a lot of the things that a lot of Trotskyist parties do. They don't use this very insular language where they keep talking about things that happened in 1953 that only other Trotskyists care about. You'll never hear Paul Murphy like rail against someone as being a Pabloite or a Schachtmanite, right? Using these like very obscure terms, or just having these incredibly long-winded speeches. I mean, Cathal and I were talking about this before we set this up, right? This is a thing that is like it's a hallmark of Trotskyism, of like 4-hour speeches, and these are like and I think that People for Profit are just smarter than that. They don't do that, and they're much more willing to learn from other political traditions and other political currents that are clearly like very strong in Ireland. Like they're willing to be feminist. I'll end with kind of one very emblematic anecdote about the WRP. They briefly got into a conversation in the early 70s with early British like second wave feminists. And there's an article that the WRP published in their newspaper where they say it's actually better to be a woman under capitalism because you don't have to go to work every day. You get to just sit at home all day. You couldn't think of an argument less likely to win over a feminist. It's utterly smug and dismissive. And it's also just totally wrong. And it doesn't understand the work that a woman does as a housewife. People Before Profit would never say something like that, partly because I think they're smarter than that, partly because I don't think they would believe that. They're willing to actually combine their Trotskyism with other things like feminism and opposition to homophobia and opposition to transphobia and things like that. The very doctrinaire politics that the WRP have and that other Trotskyist parties have kind of dooms them coming into the 1990s as these other traditions are actually becoming more active.
There's just a very final question, Maiden. You know, in
sure.
Britain, it seems to me as an outside observer, the far left have kind of latched on to basically kind of ethnic politics. You know, they had a coalition called Respect, which is very much based in the Muslim community and so on like that. They don't seem to have made a lot of progress, but that again could be something to do with the first past the post system they have over there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, some of this is like, the results, the election results you can get in a first past the post system are always going to favor larger parties. Most of the members of the WRP, when I asked them where do they, at least the ones that I was, that were willing to be interviewed by me, when I asked them where do they go afterwards, they either went into non-party political movements, so they got involved in environmentalism or pensioners' rights and things like that, or a lot of them went into the Labour Party when Jeremy Corbyn became leader and all left again once Starmer took over, or in many cases I think were just pushed out. I never came across any that were actually in any way sympathetic to George Galloway and respect, which I think a lot of people are a little bit suspicious of George Galloway.
Well, on that bombshell, Aidan, we will have to wrap it up. That was fascinating. We could talk, as we say, we could talk for another 2 or 3 hours on this, because we didn't even touch the Spartacists, which will have to be another program at another stage. But everybody should try and get your hands now on The Party Is Always Right, The Untold Story of Gerry Healy and British Trotskyism. And that's published by Pluto Press. And that's only come out in the last fortnight. So it should be really fascinating read. You've been listening to the Irish History Show. And my name is Cathal Brennan. And I'd just like to say, on behalf of myself and my co-presenter, John Dorney, thank you very much for listening. And just to say that if you want to follow us on Twitter, our handle is at Irish History Pod. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/ The Irish History Show. There's a link to the Patreon in the show notes. And if you've enjoyed this episode or any of the other episodes, please rate and review the show on Spotify or iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts. So until next time, thank you very much to Dr. Aidan Beattie. And on behalf of myself and John Dorney, thank you very much for listening.
Radio.ie hosts the Irish History Show podcast because history matters. Radio turns 100 years young this year. Radio's history is powered by Radio Archives. For radio archiving solutions from people passionate about radio, visit radio.ie.